Hi, everybody. It's Derek, and this is your Foreign Exchanges World News Roundup for Tuesday, March 19th, 2024. There are a few anniversaries. On March 19th or thereabouts in 1220, Genghis Khan's Mongol army sacked the city of Samarkand. This was one of his Genghis Khan's first big conquests in Central Asia. He had focused up until this point primarily on consolidating all the various Mongolian and other steppe tribes, and then on invading the Jin dynasty in northern China and the Xia dynasty in sort of western China. And so he was dealing with those affairs in the east, sent an embassy to the west to the Khwarezmian Empire. And the first embassy was a commercial one. It was massacred and the goods were all stolen. And then he sent another envoy to the ruler of the Khwarezmian Empire, Shah Muhammad II, and asked for the head of the governor who had killed all of his merchants. And instead, the Shah killed one of the envoys and sent him back, his body back with the other two. And it was on, basically. The Khwarezmians had no idea what they had bitten off. I have a piece on the conquest of Samarkand, the sack of the city, up at the website. If you want to check it out, it gets into some of these details. But essentially, Genghis Khan just outmaneuvered the Khwarezmians, and they really, as I say, had no chance. Committing, I should add, some of the worst atrocities in all of military history along the way. So do check that out and read it if you would like to know more about that story. On March 19th, this is another Mongol entry, actually. On March 19th, 1279, a heavily outnumbered Mongol fleet defeated a Song Dynasty fleet at the Battle of Yamen, which is in China's, today it would be located in China's Guangdong province. Despite the disparity in numbers, the Yuan were able to, or the Mongols slash Yuan were able to block the Song fleet in Yamen's harbor until it ran out of food and water. And then once the Song were desperate enough to attack, the Mongols engaged in a ruse to draw them into an engagement unprepared. In the wake of the defeat, the young Song Emperor Zhao Bing committed suicide, which brought the Song Dynasty to its final end and left China entirely in Mongolian hands. And on March 19th, 1962, French and Algerian forces began a ceasefire under the newly agreed Evian Accords that would mark the end of the fighting of the Algerian War of Independence. The accords laid out the terms of Algerian independence while preserving some French commercial and military interests and were put to an April referendum in France and a July referendum in Algeria, winning approval in both countries. Moving on to the news, a new report from the Swiss firm IQ Air finds that only 10 countries and territories around the world met or exceeded World Health Organization standards for PM2.5 air pollution last year. PM2.5, according to the New York Times, I'm quoting here, refers to solid particles less than 2.5 micrometers in size, small enough to enter the bloodstream, and it is, again, quoting from the New York Times, the deadliest form of air pollution. According to the study, air quality is particularly bad in Central and South Asia, where the four worst performing countries, Bangladesh, India, Pakistan, and Tajikistan, are located. Moving on to the Middle East, we start as ever in Israel-Palestine, where writing for Plus972 magazine, Ori Cole argues that even the U.S. government's thus far modest efforts at sanctioning West Bank settlers may lay the groundwork for significant changes to the settlement movement. I'll read you a bit of this piece. Biden's executive order leaves much room for further action, with its sights set on individuals involved in, quote, directing, enacting, implementing, enforcing, or failing to enforce policies that threaten the peace, security, or stability of the West Bank, end quote. The wording here is such that the restrictions could easily be expanded to encompass far more organizations and individuals than those named so far. After all, the settlement enterprise has always been a joint project of Israel's government, army, and legal system working in unison. With the State Department hinting at more forceful measures ahead, sanctions could soon implicate vast swaths of the Israeli state, including ministers, municipal bodies, and high-ranking security officials. They could also threaten the settler movement's funding sources, including tax-exempt donations from the U.S., which are a lifeline for even the more mainstream settlements. Moreover, Israeli banks, which have long operated in the West Bank and supported settler projects, could be forced to make sure that they aren't handling money used by sanctioned settlers or outposts. If so, the relationship between the country's largest financial institutions and one of the most powerful groups in the Israeli body politic would shatter, with unknown implications. The latest U.S. measures targeting two outposts, Moshi's Farm and Zvi's Farm, leave further room for interpretation. How will the sanctions affect the companies working with those outposts, the suppliers who deliver materials to the farms, the NGOs that send volunteers to help guard them? These questions will likely be answered in the coming weeks and months. In other news, serious fighting continued to rage in and around Gaza City's Shifa Hospital on Tuesday for the second straight day. The Israeli military, or IDF, which launched a new assault on the hospital while claiming that Hamas has begun using it as a command base for at least the second time, if we take the IDF's word for it, says that it's killed 50 militants over the past 2 days. There, too, though, we're taking the IDF's word for it. A claim of 50 dead seems reasonable, but whether they've all been militants is a question that will probably never be independently answered. It's unclear how many people have been killed or wounded in the vicinity of the hospital, in large part because they can't be brought into the hospital for treatment under the circumstances. Hamas's political leader, Ismail Haniyeh, is accusing the Israeli government of launching this latest Shifa attack in an attempt to, quote-unquote, sabotage the ceasefire negotiations that are underway in Qatar. That may be overstating things, both in terms of the likelihood of an agreement and the effect the hospital assault might have. Despite some cautious optimism from the mediators and unconfirmed reports that Hamas leaders have softened their demands, there's not much indication that these talks will actually succeed. Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu figuratively told U.S. President Joe Biden to get bent on Tuesday for what seems like the 20th time this month, assuring Knesset members that whatever the substance of his Monday phone call with Biden might have been, he has no intention of calling off the forthcoming IDF assault on Rafah. At some point, you would think Biden would get tired of this back and forth, but that assumes he sincerely wants to talk Netanyahu out of what is likely to be a catastrophic operation from a humanitarian perspective. More likely, what he wants is to be able to say that he tried to talk Netanyahu out of it. And the IDF is acknowledging that a projectile fired from the Red Sea region, presumably a Houthi missile, slipped past Israeli air defenses and landed near the port city of Eilat late Sunday. They're investigating the air defense failure. The projectile struck an unpopulated area, so it didn't cause any casualties or damage. In Iraq, Kurdistan Workers' Party, or PKK, fighters reportedly battled a Turkish military unit in northern Iraq's Duhok province on Tuesday in a clash that left at least one Turkish soldier and six PKK members dead, according to Turkish officials. The Turkish military retaliated with airstrikes against PKK positions, but there's no indication as yet of casualties. The previous day, Turkish Foreign Minister Hakan Fidan appeared to issue a threat to Iraq's Patriotic Union of Kurdistan Party, which has long-standing ties to the PKK and is one of the two ruling parties in Iraqi Kurdistan. The Turkish military has occasionally attacked PUK security forces, but it's unclear whether Turkish leaders are prepared to escalate beyond that or how the Iraqi government might respond if they did. In Yemen, a group of Houthi fighters blew up a house in that country's Baida province on Tuesday, killing at least nine people, all members of one family, and seriously damaging a number of surrounding homes, after the owner of that house allegedly lured a group of their comrades into an ambush the previous day. Two Houthi members were killed in that incident. The Houthi-run administration in northern Yemen disavowed the house bombing, characterizing it as an irresponsible reaction by those fighters to the ambush. In Iran, according to the Wall Street Journal, the European Union is internally split on the question of imposing new sanctions on that country. I'll read you a bit of this piece. The European Union is pushing back against a French-German drive to target Iran with sanctions over its provision of missiles and other military hardware to its regional allies, with senior EU officials saying new sanctions could undercut diplomacy with Tehran. France, Germany, the Netherlands, and five other EU countries wrote last month to EU foreign policy chief Josep Borrell, saying the bloc should adopt a sanctions regime that allows them to target, quote, Iranian actors which arm, fund, advise, and instruct, end quote, pro-Iran regional militias, as well as the groups themselves, according to a letter seen by the Wall Street Journal. Borrell's response, which EU officials said was backed by Washington, don't do it now. U.S. officials declined to comment. This is me again. Instead of moving to sanctions right now, it sounds like EU leaders this week will affirm an intention to sanction Iran if it supplies ballistic missiles to Russia. Now, it's possible Iran has already supplied ballistic missiles to Russia, but there's no substantial evidence to support that claim as yet. In Asia, in Armenia, Prime Minister Nikol Pashinyan appears set to make significant concessions, or a significant concession, rather, to the Azerbaijani government in an attempt to avoid a war. And this is from Eurasianet. Just read you a bit of this piece. Delimitation discussions over the Armenia-Azerbaijan border appear stuck at present over Azerbaijan's demand that it gain control of 8 villages in border areas currently under Armenian jurisdiction. Pashinyan, in comments to journalists, signaled a willingness to unilaterally hand over 4 of the disputed villages. In doing so, he also suggested a practical way of settling the boundary between the two states. His initiative appears intended to deprive Azerbaijan of a pretext to launch new military action to seize territory, including any assault that could cut Armenia's direct access to Iran. Quote, the de jure border that existed at the time of the collapse of the Soviet Union was reaffirmed by the 1991 Alma-Ata Declaration, and not only by that declaration, but also by the agreements held in Prague on October 6, 2022, end quote, Pashinyan said at a March 12th news conference. 4 of the disputed villages, Baganis, Irim, Lower Askipara, Khairimli, and Gizilhajli, were on the Azerbaijani side of the border between the two former Soviet republics and were occupied by Armenian forces in the 1990s during the First Karabakh War, which concluded in 1994 after the signing of the Alma-Ata Declaration. Citing the Alma-Ata and Prague statements, Pashinyan acknowledged that, quote, the former administrative border, which existed during the Soviet Union, is somewhat beyond that present administrative border, end quote. He went on to call for both states to reaffirm the frontier defined by the Alma-Ata Agreement. This is me again. Pashinyan has suggested to reporters that Azerbaijani officials may be preparing to go to war over these villages imminently. And even with this offer, the problem of the other 4 villages remains. All of them are, or rather were, Azerbaijani exclaves surrounded entirely by Armenian territory, products of the Soviet Union's complicated internal border structure. This wasn't a big deal when Armenia and Azerbaijan were both subordinate republics in a larger single state, but it's been a source of tension ever since that larger state's dissolution left both republics independent. In Myanmar, local media is reporting that military airstrikes killed at least 25 people, all members of the country's endangered Rohingya community, and wounded another 25 in Rakhine State on Monday. The reports can't be confirmed, but they are credible enough to have drawn a statement of concern from United Nations Secretary General Antonio Guterres on Tuesday. The Rohingya are certainly no strangers to military violence, but under the circumstances, it's unclear why Myanmar's ruling junta would target one of their villages when Rakhine State is currently embroiled in a rebellion by the Arakan army, which comes out of Rakhine's Buddhist community and is, if anything, even more hostile toward the Rohingya than the military. It's possible that the village was targeted unintentionally. In Africa, in Libya, that country's government on Tuesday closed its largest checkpoint along the Libya-Tunisia border at Ras Jadir after it was apparently attacked by what Libyan officials called outlaw groups. The Tunisian government has also reportedly closed the checkpoint from its side because of the violence. These appear to be smuggler groups who have effectively controlled Ras Jadir amid Libya's internal chaos. Now Libyan authorities are attempting to assert control over the region, and that apparently isn't going over very well. In South Sudan, the UN's South Sudanese mission issued a report on Monday finding that the number of people affected by violence in that country spiked by some 35% over the final quarter of 2023 as compared with the previous quarter. A rise in intercommunal violence was cited as the prime cause for the increase. South Sudan is supposed to hold an election sometime this year to cement the political reconciliation process begun in a 2018 peace agreement that ended, more or less, the country's civil war. This level of violence could threaten that election. In Somalia, a drone strike near Mogadishu killed at least 22 people and wounded another 21 on Tuesday, in which what the Washington Post is reporting was a Turkish operation. Now, the Turkish military has carried out drone strikes in support of Somali security forces in the past, but what's a bit strange about this strike is that there was no fighting reported in the vicinity at the time. Somali forces and Al-Shabaab fighters did clash nearby on Monday. At least 15 of the casualties were children. In Europe, in Ukraine, the Russian military says its forces captured the city of Orlivka on Tuesday. Orlivka is situated just west of Avdiivka, so the Russians are continuing to make some gains in that area following their seizure of that town last month. In Moldova, that country's government said on Tuesday that it's expelled an unnamed Russian diplomat over the conduct of the recently concluded Russian presidential election. Moscow opened 6 polling stations in Moldova's separatist Transnistria region, despite official Moldovan opposition. Presumably, the Russian government will retaliate for this expulsion at some point. In the Americas, in Colombia, the Gulf Clan, which is Colombia's largest criminal gang, announced on Tuesday that it has accepted an invitation from President Gustavo Petro's government to open peace talks. With an estimated 9,000 fighters in its ranks, the Gulf Clan is one of Colombia's largest armed groups, and the threat it poses to rival groups has reportedly been an obstacle in terms of their willingness to engage in their own peace talks with Petro's government. However, because the Gulf Clan is legally considered a criminal organization rather than a political slash ideological one, it's not covered by the law under which Petro has been able to negotiate with, for example, the National Liberation Army or ELN and ex-Revolutionary Armed Forces of Colombia or FARC factions. So Colombian authorities may have to develop a workaround to make these talks possible. In Mexico, a new poll from that country's Reforma newspaper finds that former Mexico City mayor and ruling Morena Party candidate Claudia Sheinbaum remains a prohibitive favorite to win the June 2nd presidential election. The survey has Sheinbaum at 58% support, well ahead of joint opposition candidate Xochitl Galvez at 34%. Reforma's previous poll in December had Sheinbaum ahead 54-29%. Meanwhile, Morena's quest to win at least a 2/3 majority in the Mexican Congress is up in the air, as the party has 56% support in the Reforma poll, with 16% of voters undecided. In Haiti, the Caribbean community's proposed Haitian presidential council is almost ready for its big unveiling. According to CARICOM, 6 Haitian political blocs have submitted the names of their representatives. A 7th, the Petite Dessalines Party, has rejected the council and refused to participate. And 2 at-large members drawn from civil society and the religious community are also apparently ready to go. The council will be tasked with appointing a new prime minister to replace the outgoing Ariel Henry, a new cabinet, an electoral commission, and a national security council. Whether it will have any legitimacy, seeing as how it's been created by CARICOM essentially without Haitian input, remains to be seen. Of note, every member appointed to this council is required to support an international military intervention, also organized without much Haitian input, to deal with the insurgency that is currently gripping Port-au-Prince. If you're starting to sense a theme here, specifically the conviction on the part of the international community that Haitians mustn't be allowed to actually govern their own country, you're not alone, and you might also be interested in this week's American Prestige interview, which covers that exact subject, and I have a link to that if you're not an American Prestige listener. I do have a link to that in the written newsletter tonight. And finally, in the United States, the Washington Post recounts the political decisions that have put the bloodshed in Gaza squarely in Joe Biden's lap. Let me read you an excerpt from this piece. The previously unreported meeting, this is a meeting involving a group of top foreign policy officials from the Biden administration and previous ones that was held at the White House on October 27th, shows that discrepancies were emerging far earlier than publicly known between the Biden team's internal doubts about Israel's conduct and its ironclad external support. At nearly every turn, President Biden and his aides defended the Jewish state, even as Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu defied the U.S. and everything from protecting civilians to allowing aid delivery to accepting a Palestinian state. The Israeli embassy in Washington denied claims that the Israel Defense Forces hit targets with insufficient intelligence, saying the IDF is committed to, quote, international law, end quote, and, quote, applies a thorough legal process in the selection of targets and invests significant resources to minimize harm to civilians, end quote. This article, based on interviews with 20 administration officials and outside advisors, examines how Biden, more than 5 months after the October 7th attacks, has found himself deeply entangled in a war he does not want and that threatens to become a defining element of his tenure. His allies privately acknowledge that it has done him significant damage domestically and globally and could easily become his biggest foreign policy cataclysm. Biden's strategy from the outset rested on a central trade-off that if he showed Israel unequivocal, even defiant support early on, he could ultimately influence its conduct of the war. Some administration officials now concede the strategy is heading toward failure, and in private talks, they voice a striking frustration and uncertainty about how the war will end. Of course, you know, in my opinion, this is me again, I think all of these stories about how frustrated the Biden administration is with the Israeli government are stage managed. They are meant for domestic voters. They mean nothing. They are very carefully curated. But even so, I think it's worth pointing out that this is blowing up in Joe Biden's face. It's not working. Whatever he hoped to achieve here, it has backfired on him in a huge way, just in the basic political cost, not even factoring in the moral abomination of what is happening in Gaza and how much of that now rests on Joe Biden's shoulders. Anyway, I've digressed enough. That's all for us this evening. Thanks to all of you for reading and or listening to the newsletter, and especially to those of you who are Foreign Exchange subscribers and make this newsletter possible. Until next time, take care, and I'll talk to you soon. Bye-bye.